out of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
I guess I've always thought of us here at Canada Land as pirates, as punks, as pornographers. You know, as the upstarts outside the gate, rattling the cages and you know, all the cliches. I've liked that conception. I haven't wanted respectability. But how does that conception hold up when the big guys, the legacy corporate players, are collapsing all around us? Just last week, Bell laid off 4,800 people, and they announced that they are selling dozens of radio stations. So how do we go on defining ourselves as the other when the thing that we're defining ourselves against seems like it's on its last gasps? To get some insight into this question, I'm going to turn to a unlikely source, but a familiar one to you. You heard me interview Max Krangel a few weeks ago. He spent 12 years as a high-paid lawyer for big tobacco. What I haven't told you yet is that he also has experience in the porno business, and he has things to say about the booze business and gambling and firearms. And I got to thinking, does his thesis that regulations can make you rich, they are not the enemy, well, could it be applied to media? We are entering a new, highly regulated media framework in Canada. And my instinct, my reflex, is to push against that like a punk. But what if there's something in it for us? What if this is the key to sustainability for a company like Canada Land? Max Krangel, Part 2. So here you are, you've left big tobacco, but you have an area of expertise, which is extensive experience navigating a detested, highly regulated industry as it discovers that despite that animosity and despite the government supposedly regulating it out of existence, it can become more profitable than ever. And you decide that you're going to take that know-how to every other industry that you can.
That's exactly what I've been trying to do. And with some success, I wasn't even 40 years old and still a career ahead of me. I have the experience, the very unique experience of being ex-general counsel of R.J. Reynolds International and ex-assistant general counsel of Japan Tobacco International. And what comes with that is some very high-level experience dealing with regulation and dealing with legal problems and dealing with risk and bringing that to various other industries.
It sounds like that's not all you do. And you wrote the book on this counterintuitive idea that regulations can be your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Apply that for me to an industry that is different than tobacco. We know that industries fight tooth and nail to prevent regulations. They lobby the hell out of governments to not regulate them. They want to have the power. How is this good for business other than tobacco?
I think tobacco sort of sits on a pulpit of its own, aside from all of these other industries, for one specific reason. There are no safe levels of smoking.
Alcohol kills a lot of people, too.
Absolutely it does, and it is a carcinogen, and it has its own issues. But the government and medical professionals, at least today in the year 2024, this seems to be rapidly evolving as well.
Firearms, that's an industry that has a high death count every year?
It certainly does, but then remember that firearms are also used not just for home protection for our friends south of the border, but they're also used legitimately for hunting. They're used in the military and elsewhere.
So, my point being, though, that these are both industries that are highly regulated, and there's lots of good reasons for that, but can you make the argument that the regulations can be the industry's friend? Wouldn't they just be making a lot more money if there were no regulations of alcohol sales or firearms sales?
So the answer is it depends. So many of these industries, the firearms and alcohol industries, are starting to and already have adopted the, if you want, like I like to call it, the ostrich approach. that the tobacco industry had from the mid-1960s up into the 90s. And that's denying that there's any problem and fighting the regulations. And instead of embracing it and working with the government as their business partner, they are going down that initial road that big tobacco went on. Where that ends for them, I don't know. But what I can bring to them is the learning on how shifting your mentality, shifting your business model, shifting your priorities, treating your relationships with the general public, with the government, with your customers differently, has reaped benefits.
If anyone is more hated than big tobacco, it is the firearm industry. I take from your point of view that denying this horrific problem of mass shootings, not only is this disastrous to their brand, but it might actually be bad for business. And if they simply say, okay, we make a deadly product, it needs to be tightly regulated, there may be a path forward that leads to greater profits for them.
Yes, I think so. Of course, they are not currently facing the same level of lawsuits and potential financial ruin that the tobacco industry faced in the late 1990s. So their incentives may be to be a bit more open about this and treat this the way tobacco did might be a little bit further on.
You have examples of industries that might benefit from embracing regulation, and there might be an upside for them. Has anyone taken your advice, I suppose, and won?
Yes. A great one, I think, is the online gambling industry.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bit of a free-for-all still. Because of the nature of the internet, quite frankly, why anybody, for example, outside the province of Ontario or any other Canadian province would gamble on a website or with a bookmaker that is outside their province, to me, seems crazy that they would even do that, because there's zero proof that you're being treated fairly.
You
that
have
the odds
no
are
idea.
Fair.
I only know about gambling from playing poker, and knowing that there are only 52 cards in the deck gives me some assurance as to the fairness. You're online. You have no, there's an algorithm that has every incentive to just be ensuring that it extracts more money from you. Not only extracts more money from you than you put in, but is like gaming you to figure out exactly, I assume that it is studying the player to figure out how much money to get out of that player.
I would assume that's correct, but when you play an online game that is run by the government of Ontario or regulated by the government of Ontario, you are assured a very robust level of protection.
Uh-huh.
It's when you start gambling on online casinos that are in the Windward Islands or in the Caribbean, not only are you not necessarily playing a fair game, but if you magically were to win a jackpot...
Would you get the money,
right? That industry, which is very profitable, as you can possibly imagine,
yeah.
Generally speaking, these industries get themselves into trouble when consumers start complaining. And whether it's the FTC in the United States or a regulatory body here in Canada, consumers complain when they feel that they get ripped off or they get sick or they have some other kind of problem. One of the pieces of learning that I've brought to them is this idea of voluntary compliance.
This is what industries have done when under threat of regulation since time immemorial. My first knowledge of this came as a comic book fan when there was a moral panic about comic books and about Bill Gaines, Crypt of Horror comics, Seduction of the Innocent. What did the comic industry do? They created the Comics Code Authority. We are a self-regulating censor. What did the video game industry do? What was the Hays Code in movies? All of these industries that were considered sin industries at a certain point said, don't regulate us. That's the last thing we want. We'll regulate ourselves.
Yes, and that tends to work for sure.
Advertising, yeah.
Advertising standards authorities, and it keeps the regulators away for sure. It doesn't always work, but there are still many countries in the world, believe it or not, where you don't have to put health warnings on packets of cigarettes or cannabis products or so on and so forth, but the industry still does it. So that's one very simple thing that you can do, but you look at the past and say, well, look, one of the problems that we've had, that the tobacco industry has had in the smoking health debate is that there was a failure to warn. You knew this product was bad, but you didn't tell us. Well, if we've been voluntarily putting health warnings on packets of cigarettes for 50 years now, and in many jurisdictions where it's not legally required, but still doing it, that's something that you can proactively do to mitigate your risk going forward in the future. It may seem quite obvious, but it's often very hard.
Don't wait until you have to. Just do it voluntarily.
Do it voluntarily.
Because it's not the crime, it's the cover-up.
But also, from a legal perspective, when you're looking for making someone liable for the actions that they have caused, the tariff card for the damages that get assessed increases exponentially when there's negligence involved,
mm-hmm.
right? So, yeah, your company may have done something wrong, but it's very different than doing something wrong and knowing about it and still not doing anything.
Right. So what you're preaching now is advice of liability protection, protecting against lawsuits. That's not necessarily a business opportunity. It's just downward risk assessment. It's not the same thing as like, well, there's actually a great way to make money here. There's just a way to protect yourself against losing money.
Yes, but equally, if you adopt the tobacco approach of working with the government on making the product more expensive, then that is a business approach, because as we started by talking...
Accepting the taxation. Yeah, and then exploiting it to increase your profit margins, mm-hmm. which is, you know, certainly if people are addicted to your product or if it's just an incredibly compelling, if it's a sin product. Can I ask you for some legal advice?
Well, I can try. I'm not sure I'm qualified to give you that legal advice, so I'd happily give you some advice as a friend, but go ahead. As a friend who happens to be a lawyer.
My industry is facing regulation to a degree that it never has before, and maybe for the first time. Journalism has vociferously, historically resisted regulation, not based on business reasons explicitly, but based on principle. That an independent press is necessary and that journalism is a human right and that it should not be the protected class of a certain professional class. All of that has changed.
Mm-hmm.
We now have an industry that has been lobbying for regulations. They wanted regulations because they wanted subsidies. And if you're going to get subsidies, then you are de facto regulated because... Who is a journalist becomes a question that gets settled by the government, at least to the extent of who gets the money. And the industry has successfully lobbied for regulations of the platforms that we rely on for news distribution, Google and Facebook. I have resisted this. I have been against this on principle because I am a newcomer relatively to this industry. And my argument has been kind of compatible with yours, which is to say all that this is going to do is lock in the incumbents. Because the more regulation you put in, even if it's to protect the media, it's red tape that makes it harder to enter the industry. And you become like that pack of cigarettes behind the closed case.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're kind of in. We've been here for 10 years. We can get our government status. Should I, as a news publisher, be embracing these regulations or fighting them?
I think the answer depends on what it is that you're trying to do. Are you trying to uphold journalistic integrity, to remain independent, to allow for the traditional definition of the freedom of the press to continue long into the future, and to be able to report on and say what you believe is in the best interests of the general public without government interference? Is that what you'd like to do? Or is what you want to do make money? I think there are differences between the two and significant differences between the two. The classic example, which a lot of Canadians, and this is not limited Canadians, people around the world, people love to knock Fox News,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's this so-called right-wing American broadcaster that has a journalistic code with traditionally Rupert Murdoch at the helm trying to bring a narrative to the American general public. Should that entity receive any government funding? Well, no, that is a private business. So the question is, should that private business have to explain to the general public, effectively provide some kind of health warning to their product itself to say, please watch Fox News. When we say it's fair and balanced, what we mean is we believe it's fair and balanced, but there are other people out there that you have to understand that the views expressed by the anchors and the news reporters on Fox News are traditionally right of center, and please note that. Now, you know, are we talking about how you portray the facts, or are we talking about regulating who's allowed to say what?
Well, it's a big mess, isn't it? But you've really hit upon it because, and this is ways in which we are similar to some of the products and some of the contentious industries and sin categories that you have expertise in, and then there's a way in which we're not. We're weird. We're contradictory. We're both. You ask me, do I want to uphold the principles of the press or do I want to make money? I want to do both. And then to this question of, is this a product that is bad for you that requires like a health risk warning? Some people would say yes. And there's a growing body of research that would say, not just Fox News because of bias, but that the rage generation of news online, the algorithmic exploitation of your cortisol levels, of your stimulus, of the affirmation you get from a retweet or a like, from seeing confirmation bias, from, you know, there's a sick pleasure that humans get from seeing, like, and it's funny to me, people even write to me saying, I want more stories that tell me what I already think and know. They want it.
Mm-hmm.
It feels good, and it feels good to be angry. And it's making people sick. There is science that shows that the effect this has on you in many ways, the anger, being exposed to traumatic things from around the world that you can do nothing about, and is news good? Like, people will say, I am on a news diet because it was hurting my mental health. And some people would argue that we have a toxic product. And then there is this other argument that the industry is making, that this is like your vegetables. This is the most crucial product that is good for you. How can a person possibly make good decisions, good health decisions, good decisions on who to vote for, good decisions on what to buy, without an independent press? And the contradiction there is that in order to preserve this independent press, we must become dependent on subsidies. And in order to get subsidies, we'll need regulations. So we're in a very confused and mixed up place. And to your question of like, which path do I want to take? I've come to a certain conclusion that I don't necessarily have a choice. The only choice I have, like, regulations are a fact, and the only choice I have, which is meaningful, is you don't have a choice as to whether or not to be regulated.
Mm-hmm.
You have a choice as to whether or not to accept subsidies, and my choice has been to not accept them. If I look at this purely cynically, though, the same reason why I opposed regulation to begin with, that it would basically make the red tape would increase and it would be so much harder to start up a new, and I've always tried to advocate for small upstarts because we need them,
mm-hmm.
but I also have a position as a publisher. I have an interest in my position is I've clambered up the ladder. And even if I'm not the one to knock it away, hey, nice to be at the top when the ladder gets knocked away. If it becomes impossible to launch a news company, but we are within the bounds of regulation as a recognized news company, whether or not we take the subsidies, it's nice to be in a protected industry.
A couple of things I would challenge you on there. First is, you say you don't take any subsidy. Just merely by being a broadcaster in Canada, you are taking a subsidy of sorts by being regulated and protected by the CRTC. So
no, we're not. We're not. We're not classified as a broadcaster.
So there's
as a podcaster. We're not CRTC regulated.
You have no requirements for Canadian content across any of your networks?
No, there's an open question as to whether or not a new piece of regulation will ultimately place us within, and the CRTC is coming into the picture in this limited capacity as a decision maker on who gets Google's money, which is not being classified as a subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the Broadcasting Act, a podcaster is at this moment, they've recently introduced a level of haze into this with Bill C-11, that a podcast network of a certain level may be CRTC regulated,
mm-hmm.
And then they backtracked on that.
Okay.
Right now, we are not within the CRTC's regime.
Okay. So you're in a situation, which I think is great, because it certainly changes the dynamic of what you are trying to do if you need to conform to the CRTC regulations. There is a lot of negativity about what the CRTC does, but there are all very good benefits to what they do as well.
Well, the biggest thing that they do is they offer you a protected market. There are millions of podcasts out there. There are only hundreds of TV channels.
Right.
If the benefit, I would hate for podcasting to become a CRTC thing, but if that did happen, I'd want to be in, not out.
So take yourself a little bit further back then, and then say, okay, yeah, there are hundreds of TV channels and thousands of podcasts, but that wasn't the case 20, 30 years ago. Looking at the news industry, it was very closed 30 years ago. I mean, you know, if you're trying to sell a newspaper in the city of Toronto, you had the Toronto Star, you had the Toronto Sun, and you had the Globe and Mail. This is pre-National Post days, and they had a pretty much monopoly on the post boxes and the distribution networks around the
Absolutely.
City.
Absolutely. TV was like three news networks.
networks?
Absolutely. Newspapers, one or two per city. It was, I mean, I'm a journalist of the internet era, mm-hmm. and that's what I feel like I'm fighting for, was what that brought, mm-hmm. the openness and the democratization that that brought to our industry.
You're now in a situation where many more people can bring news to the market. I guess what comes with that and the big change, I'm not sure, and I guess I was a young man or a little boy when in the era that I'm referring to in the past, so my mind might not be capable of making this determination, but you'd like to think that those limited journalistic outlets in those days, whether they be a few newspapers, a few TV stations, a few radio stations, and some wire networks, they had a journalistic code and a journalistic integrity, and so far as they complied with the freedom of press legislation in various countries, they were left what they wanted to do. When things started expanding with the advent of cable and satellite television, and which brought many more players into the market, and the advent of CNN and 24-hour news networks, and then you had it all expanding again in the mid to late 90s with the internet age and various websites bringing news and the likes of that, bringing all of those products online, massive expansion of TV channels, then YouTube, podcasts, and so forth. It's changed everything again. I guess my question to you is, because things have changed, you say, should you take the government money or not? My question to you, without looking at the regulatory side of it, is, well, why do you need the government money? If you're not able to run this business without the government money, and others are, then is this a viable business? Or is the question, we're all facing the same thing, and without the government subsidy that goes with this regulation, none of us would be able to compete, which I think is a very different question.
The larger question is, as this C-11 thing becomes a reality, they're trying to grandfather in a scheme that is like the broadcasting regime. The more you do this, the harder it is for incumbents to get in, but, you know, the whole industries in Canada form around exploiting these systems and taking out more than you can put in and manipulating who works on a project so that you've got enough Canadians that you can qualify for this tax credit or that. Mm-hmm. The wheel is still in spin, and there is still a fight that is possible to resist or to say, well, this shouldn't cover us. Now, the enforcement of C-11 and who it's going to apply for, that is a viable fight. And it's possible that I could become part of a fight to, like, just leave us the f*** alone. Mm-hmm. But everything that you are telling me about the tobacco industry and elsewhere says, like, look, why are you fighting so hard? If you could actually get into this scheme, it could be a lot better for you than if you are fighting so vociferously for it to include everybody but you.
That's true, but it did take a long time to get there. This was not a decision that was made in 1965, 1 year after the Surgeon General's report. Things had to get pretty bad and pretty dire, and looking like this was potentially the end of the industry as we know it today in the United States because of all of these lawsuits that were pending. So I think you're at a very, very different position. I challenge you, though, to explain why would taking government money necessarily affect your independence? Or put another way, why does any kind of monopolistic or control behavior necessarily change your journalistic dependence? I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, if you and I wanted to start a professional ice hockey team to play in the National Hockey League, barring the fact that we don't necessarily have the money, you know, it's a closed shop. We can't do it. We can't get into there. But no one would, I would not make a claim to say that there are problems with the integrity of the game integrity or the fairness of the rules of the NHL because it's regulated by the government and it's closed.
Yeah.
And there's a closed shop.
I'll answer that question, and it's a question that every journalist I know who has accepted, you know, either actively accepted government subsidy or they're part of a company that does, they make the same argument. They say, look, I'm doing my job exactly the same as I used to, so what's changed? Every journalist whose salary is subsidized by legislation introduced by the Trudeau government or by increases to the CBC's funding that have come about as a result of the Trudeau government knows that depending on who runs this country, those subsidies might disappear. And the most honorable, impartial, uncorruptible journalist knows when covering Pierre Poilievre that this is a political figure who represents a real intangible threat to their paycheck. And I give absolute confidence as somebody who loves reporters and journalists and knows how important their principles are to them, that I am a citizen who has every confidence that most of these journalists will not let that affect their coverage one iota. But the public is reasonable in decreasing their level of faith in that journalist, knowing that that journalist has an interest in which government forms power. That is a reasonable conclusion. That is a reasonable suspicion. And the independence of the press is not simply a practical matter that you can report the news independently. It is a public trust. And it only works when the public trusts us. And they trust us less than they ever have. So, to your earlier question, if you don't need the money, maybe don't take it. That's where I've landed on that one, is if we can survive without it, let's survive without it. I want to ask you about one other contentious industry that I know you're involved in, and that is an industry that is under incredible pressures for regulation, and there's all kinds of moral panic about it, and people are, in a very similar way, associating lots of dangers with it. That is the adult entertainment business.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about your involvement in that business?
Sure. I mean, I can't speak to the names of the specific clients themselves, but that I have looked at, worked in a number of projects, whether it being acquiring the rights to the Playboy collection, to various operators that have adult websites worldwide, whether that be pornography or adult cams or also adult products such as vibrators and other products like that. It is a huge, huge, huge business and continues to be so.
You have represented those clients, or do you have any other involvement in that industry?
I've represented, and I'm part of a company that has some involvement in that industry as well.
You know, there was a Nicholas Kristof article, you might have caught in the New York Times, about Pornhub. We've done some coverage of these Canadians who started MindGeek, Pornhub. They're really mysterious international figures. One of them had their house burned down, and there was this piece that essentially held them responsible for exploitation of minors and revenge porn and all sorts of things. And there was a sense that enough is enough, that something is going to be done about pornography.
There needs to be some markers in the sand here, particularly in regards to pornography. I think, first of all, it's very important for people to understand that the value of the adult pornographic industry is larger than the Hollywood movie industry. So to put that in perspective, despite the fact that many people deny that they watch any kind of pornography, there are more movies made and more money made in the adult industry than the motion picture industry.
I kind of knew that stat, but it still blows me away whenever I...
Absolutely. And so you think to yourself, well, if that's the case, a lot more people must be watching this than they're actually letting on. So that in itself is worthy of a discussion of, well, what exactly is going on here? But if we take that as read, that is a very big part of it. There are very strict laws in the United States, which is where most of the pornography is made. There's a little bit made in Europe, but California and Florida are the epicenters of pornography production. There are very strict laws, which have been in place for many years, to do with making sure that no one in any of these films is under the age of 18 or appears under the age of 18. There are various initiatives and rules in place about what is considered violent and not violent. There are various condom regulations and safe sex regulations and health regulations regarding the performers themselves. So the legitimate business is very profitable and is alive and well and needs to be distinguished from the darker side of this, which are these illegal porn websites, whether they be porn that features children or people under the age of 18, which is highly illegal in every country in the world, and these so-called revenge porn websites and the likes.
And
then
we're getting into deep fakes and stuff like that.
Correct.
What I saw happen with Pornhub following that article was, this self-regulation thing where they voluntarily removed, because there is this professionalized or corporatized porn industry largely based in California, though also produced in Quebec quite a bit. But then Pornhub also, the YouTube of porn, everybody can upload their own porn, and that is almost impossible to ensure compliance when you have a system like that. And my understanding is that they basically kicked off all of the user-generated content, and to simply define things as the light and the dark, we got rid of the dark. Well, there were also, and this is similar to the journalism argument, the more tight the regulations get, there was a whole class of independent content providers that were on the losing end of that. And there are lots of people who are paying their rent by doing adult performance and adult content. And that, those were sort of like the acceptable attrition.
Yeah, it has shifted. Obviously, these platforms, Pornhub and YouPorn, and there are others, but those are the two big names there. Business model has shifted dramatically over the last 10 years. They were originally this sort of shared space where we would envisage, much like YouTube, uploading your own content to that. The problems associated with that, particularly with the laws regarding age verifications and checks, become almost impossible. And the likes of revenge porn and all sorts of other problems and problematic content getting uploaded to there would have been the end of these websites as far as litigation and government shutdown goes, had they not changed their business model. Mm-hmm. Their business model now is